Welcome to South Asia Chat, a podcast brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. I'm your host, Ramita Iyer, research analyst at the Institute. South Asia Chat is currently running a three-part series on the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework in light of the substantial progress made in the negotiations. In case you missed the first part, do listen to the previous episode with Professor Peter Draper, who provides an Australian perspective on the developments. For more introductory information on the IPEF, as well as details on negotiation progress earlier this year, do listen to episodes 146 and 186. In today's second part of the IPEF series, I'm pleased to be joined by an expert from India, Ms. R.V. Anuradha, partner, Claris Law Associates, India. Anuradha, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Ramita. Thank you for inviting me.
So India was an active engager in the discussions and negotiations of Pillar 2 of the IPEF on supply chains. Do you think that the outcomes have fulfilled India's expectations in this regard?
I think, yeah, that's a question which is multi-layered. And let me try and attempt to give you my perspectives on it. Perhaps, you know, before we get on to the supply chain pillar itself, it's good to at the outset highlight some of the basic introductory points to set the context for IPEF. Now, as we all know, it's an ambitious new conceptualization, or I should say reconceptualization, of bilateral and regional economic agreements. It does not follow the traditional path of a free trade agreement, which has at its focus tariff elimination. Of course, there are the newer age FTAs, many of the recent FTAs, which have been increasingly delving into regulatory issues such as standards, environment, labor, sustainability, etc. But the overall thrust of IPEF is predominantly on a variety of regulatory issues, and there's no focus on tariff-related aspects at all. In fact, as you would know, that's one of the major criticism or skepticism of IPEF in terms of whether it can actually yield market access or whether it's going to be more of a range of soft principles. And while the supply chain pillar outcome has been announced, what we have in the public domain is not the formal text of the agreement. So to a large extent, we are still speculating, we are still groping in the dark, and depending on whether one is a pessimist or optimist or somewhere in between, there are different views in terms of how this is likely to manifest itself in terms of new architectures in economic agreements. Having said that, again, the clear context for IPEF is also what the world has seen in the past few years. Of course, the COVID-19 pandemic, the China-US disagreements and disenchantment and disengagement. There is also rising protectionism worldwide. There is the Russia-Ukraine war. So all of these, you know, set the context in terms of how countries are re-looking at economic engagements. What is not clear is whether IPEF agreements in themselves, the four pillars, will be a distinct departure in terms of legal architecture, or whether they'll simply be similar agreements without delving into tariff liberalization. So for instance, on the supply chain pillar, the key elements in terms of the wish list of countries, including the statement that had come from the government of India, the key elements lie in the hope that this will lead to diversification of supply chains, reduce reliance on China, and thereby add a fillip to domestic manufacturing. So the government of India's press release, for instance, highlighted potential shift on for production centers in key goods and critical sectors into India, enhancing our own domestic capabilities, perhaps tying in very well with India's own vision of Atmanirbhar Bharat or self-reliant India, and the range of production-linked initiatives that have been announced for encouraging manufacturing in India, mobilizing investments in production of key goods and logistics services, deeper integration into global value chains and supply chains. So all of that is very exciting. But in terms of the legal text, what is it that we know? we know for a fact that this is going to be a unique bottom-up approach, which will involve each country engaging with businesses and utilizing technical assistance and capacity building to enhance investment in critical sectors. Now, a very interesting component of this is that there is no set list of critical sectors or key goods that the supply chain arrangement is expected to cover. On the other hand, the bottom-up approach actually requires every IPIF member to come up with its own list of what is critical to it. And that will form the core base for the supply chain agreement. So being a reliable supply chain partner, logically, would also raise expectations of businesses within a country to not have trade barriers to key goods and to critical sectors that require those key goods. To give an example, during the industry consultations that happened in the US, the US consultations actually preceded the announcement of the IPIF ministerial statements themselves. So the pharma industry, for example, in its wish list of expectations from IPIF, spoke about the need for eliminating tariffs and export restrictions and other barriers on biopharmaceuticals, inputs into those sectors, related supplies. And of course, it spoke about development and trade facilitation aspects as well. So if we were to look at it in terms of if this is the wish list for each country, in India, for example, I would imagine that given our path to a low carbon economy, our wish list should typically comprise of identification of climate-friendly technologies, climate-friendly inputs and goods as critical sector and key goods for which we are seeking market access or for which we are seeking a supply chain resilience within the framework of the supply chain pillar. So yes, whether this will manifest itself in the letter of the law, it's at this stage a little hard to predict. But given what the government has announced, one of the other interesting aspects it also announced was deeper integration for Indian MSMEs. Now, logically, this is going to happen if there is going to be an assurance of supply, there is going to be an assurance of access for MSMEs into other markets. So how this entire ecosystem actually evolves in terms of the nitty-gritties of the text of the agreement, I would say one would know only once this comes out in the public domain.
So while much is still unknown about the IPIF, one of the things that has been made public is establishing a tripartite IPIF labor rights advisory board that will help identify areas where labor rights concerns pose risks to the resilience and competitiveness of the partner supply chains. Now, given that labor issues have always been contentious and India has also expressed concerns regarding this, do you see it being comfortable in working with the proposed advisory board?
Well, India has agreed, at least in terms of the in-principle elements of the supply chain arrangement. And you're right that among the institutional frameworks, it has this very interesting labor rights advisory board. In fact, labor rights and worker-centric philosophy is something that runs through each of the pillars of the IPIF. So it's not unique to the supply chain initiative alone. Neither is it surprising to see that this has been one of the outcomes because the ministerial statement itself had, way back last year, had focused on how labor-related issues will be a component of the supply chain pillar also. Now, from India's perspective, as you know, we've opted out so far from the IPIF trade pillar. And when India's Minister for Commerce and Industry, Mr. Piyush Goyal, had opted out last year, he had explained that while the Indian officials would participate in the trade pillar with an open mind, among the concerns were concerns relating to environment and labor. And the reason for this, as you also pointed out, is that this has been an extremely sensitive issue, not because India has anything to worry about labor rights. On the other hand, we have a very robust framework. Labor is an element in the concurrent list of the Constitution, which means that both the central and state governments are responsible for implementing labor-related issues. India has been a member of the International Labor Organization. We are signatories to 6 of the 8 core conventions on protection of labor. This is unlike the United States, which has actually signed only up to 4 of the core conventions. So none of this is really a matter of concern in terms of labor per se. But where the concern really lies is the interlinkage of trade and labor. Economic arrangement and labor-related issues. And the reason for that is because labor is a non-trade issue, and the underlying concern has always been that social clauses such as labor-related clauses could end up being protectionism in the guise of humanitarian concerns. So one of the outcomes of the WTO ministerials had actually been that members of the WTO recognize the importance of ILO's core labor standards, but at the same time, economic advantage of low-wage countries should not be questioned. So now, how does this interlink with the Supply Chain Labor Advisory Board? Again, the devil lies in the details, and we don't know those details so far. But yes, at the outset, I would imagine that any prescriptive labor conditions would certainly raise competitiveness concerns. A clear example, one of the most stark examples of this was in the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement, the USMCA, which replaced the NAFTA, which mandated that at least 40 to 45% of automobile content must be made by workers earning a minimum wage of $16 per hour. Now, this is the minimum wage applicable in the US. Mexico's minimum wage in relation to the auto sector is significantly lesser. So, clearly, a conditionality such as this would potentially raise competitiveness concerns. Now, in the context of IPIF's supply chain pillar, in the absence of any core obligations relating to labor, this is perhaps, hopefully, unlikely. But at the same time, what would be the role of the Labour Advisory Board? What will be the legal format of its interaction? What will be the level of external scrutiny? Because you're right, you mentioned that this Labour Advisory Board will be tripartite in terms of government representatives, business representatives, and workers' representatives. Does this would obviously mean not just of the country making the supply, but of the country procuring the supply also. So this would, to a large extent, entail an external scrutiny, for example, by US government, US employers, businesses, and US workforce on how a supplier in India's labor-related conditions actually play out in terms of the entire format of the supply chain. The supply chain official summary that was announced at the end of May notes that the advisory board would support IPIF's partners' promotion of labor rights in their supply chain, promote sustainable trade and investment, facilitate opportunities for investment that respect labor rights, etc. Now, so far so good, but insofar as this pertains to enforcement of domestic laws on labor through an external scrutiny, if there is an expectation of higher than domestic law standards applicable in those supply chain elements, I would imagine that this could potentially become a sensitive issue for India. Insofar as the role of this advisory board is, however, deferential to, say, the Government of India's stand and affirmations on adherence to domestic laws, then it may not be that big an issue.
Moving to the other pillars, there is an expectation that by November this year, a substantial part of the IPEF will be concluded. From an Indian perspective, what are your thoughts on the progress that could be made on the remaining pillars on trade, clean economy, and fair economy? And what decisions can we expect in the coming months?
The trade pillar, as you know, India has so far opted out, but there have been recent news reports which indicate that because India is already an observer in the trade pillar, whether it will formally join or not remains an open one. So there is a possibility that India may consider joining the trade pillar, particularly considering that in the wake of the Prime Minister's visit this week to the US, there was actually an inaugural meeting of the India-US Strategic Trade Dialogue that was held in early June. And while the focus of that was particularly on critical domains such as semiconductors, space, telecom, AI, defense, biotech, etc., this does tie in well with the expectations of what the IPF is meant to do as well. So whether this will accelerate India joining the trade pillar of IPF, it's still an open question, but I wouldn't be very surprised if it does. Coming to the other pillars, the clean energy and decarbonization pillar has been, the pillar three has been one of the more important pillars along with the supply chain pillar. This will be, as I mentioned earlier, in terms of India's own climate-related obligations and need for access to technology and critical goods for accelerating its move to low-carbon growth. In terms of climate finance and access to climate finance, I would imagine that this pillar would hold tremendous potential. As of now, the outcomes simply indicate significant progress, but do not really articulate what are the elements of that progress so far. But I do see good and neat interlinkages with the supply chain pillar, for example, in terms of ensuring access to critical goods and technology that can enhance the path towards clean energy development. And hopefully we'll see something concrete sooner. On the last pillar, now that's the fair economy pillar. The anti-corruption component is one part of it. The one that interests me more is the one relating to international taxation. Now, the IPF ministerial statement last year had not really indicated any new disciplines on the international taxation component. Rather, it reiterated the need for synergizing with OECD's inclusive framework on base erosion and profit sharing two-pillar solution, the OECD BEPS, as we call it. And this really pertains to addressing tax challenges from digitization of the economy. Again, as we all know, digitization has thrown up significant challenges for taxation, and some countries, including India, have gone the unilateral way. So in the absence of any kind of agreement with OECD, which has been discussing this issue for over a decade, India had, a few years back, introduced the digital service tax in the form of equalization levy. In fact, the US had initiated Section 301 proceedings against India and I think at least 10 other countries that had introduced similar taxes. And each of that, after a period of consultations and investigations, seemed to have led to a little bit of slowing down on both sides because of the fact that there's been greater convergence at the OECD on the two-pillar approach. And significant progress has been made with close to over 130 countries agreeing towards a two-pillar approach. But the elements of that is yet to be fleshed out. So whether the IPEF announcement on the fair economy pillar, will that end up being merely an endorsement or a commitment to coordinate and speed up the process for the OECD solution, or whether it will be anything more concrete at this stage, I am actually very curious to see that outcome. And while again significant progress has been announced, no text has come out yet.
Finally, I want to touch upon a broader issue. So as we know, India is increasingly engaging with a large number of countries for free trade agreements. The IPEF, of course, as you mentioned, deviates from this conventional FTA structure since it does not provide market access concessions or tariff liberalization measures. Now, given this, from a trade negotiator's perspective and also a business perspective, do you see the IPEF being as attractive as an FTA? For example, you know, the EU-India FTA that's currently being negotiated.
That's a very interesting question. And let me answer it more from a neutral trade observer's perspective. Again, I would say there's too much up in the air for IPEF. So while we may not get any tariff assurances, we are not going to get, for example, restoration of India's GSP, the Generalized System of Preferences, that the US had withdrawn a few years back. We may not also get an elimination of the 10 and 25% tariffs on steel and aluminium sectors that the United States had imposed under what it called its national security-related provision, Section 232 of their tariff law. So we're not going to get any of that. But at the same time, as I mentioned, because of the significant focus on regulatory-related issues, there is going to be market access eventually, because ironing out of supply chain, logistics, transfer of technology, access to goods and services, ultimately all lead up to market access. So to that extent, there was in fact a recent U.S. Congressional Research Report, the CRS report, which noted that while they are naysayers even within the U.S. in terms of whether an IPEF is as good as a trade agreement or it's going to be a very low ambition, not really achieving anything concrete, while all of those questions still remain, it also highlighted that by addressing the kind of regulatory issues that it is, the IPEF is certainly going to have an impact on hopefully smoothing or easing market access. So, yes, I think even if tariffs are not eased in sectors that are critical, critical for us, there could be some expectations in terms of the economic advantages of being part of the deal. But there is another element that is slightly unclear at this stage, which is in relation to how are those commitments going to be enforced? Will there be an IPEF dispute resolution mechanism, for instance? As you know, the ability or the validity of any law, whether domestic or international, is in its ability to lead to binding legal commitments, enforceable commitments. And how is that going to be achieved, whether it is only soft power in terms of dialogue and discussions, or whether it will be through an enforceable dispute mechanism? That perhaps will also determine how effective this agreement is. The other FTA negotiations, you mentioned the EU-India, but other than that, India has been on almost, accelerated its momentum towards concluding free trade agreements with the UK. We've already concluded an interim agreement with Australia, full-fledged FTAs with Mauritius and UAE. We are also negotiating a further enhanced cooperation agreement with Australia, further FTA negotiations with Canada, with EU, other than with EU, with EFTA as well, and with New Zealand also. Now, these FTA negotiations, to a large extent, are more predictable because they take the well-trodden path. So therefore, there will be chapters on goods, which will talk about tariff-related issues, non-tariff barriers also. There will be issues in terms of market access for services on both sides. At the same time, there are also not such well-trodden paths. So particularly in our FTAs with EU, with UK, with EFTA, with Canada, these ones are likely to see the emergence of non-trade issues such as labor, environment, sustainability, etc., becoming central and core focus areas of these FTAs. So to what extent you know, India will be able to essentially set down its own expectations in these areas? How is it able to balance out these issues which it has so far not accepted in a free trade agreement commitment? That also remains to be seen. So coming back to your question in terms of the attractiveness of the IPF format or the traditional FTA format, I think it's we don't know enough to make an effective comparison at this stage. Let me go back to what I mentioned in terms of the excitement the IPF holds is really because a lot of it is unknown factors. It's exciting because of that unknownness that remains. But hopefully by the end of the year, once the legal texts are out, we'll be able to make a more reasoned and well-informed assessment of that.
Anuradha, thank you so much for sharing your insights. You were listening to South Asia Chat. To learn more about our work, visit us at isas.nus.edu.sg. You can also get updates from social media. We're on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram.